come on a journey with a cinephile.
Wake up, sucker. We're thieves and we're bad guys. That's exactly what we are.
Listeners to episode 228 of Journey with a Cinephile, a horror movie podcast. As always, I'm your tour guide here of David Garrett Jr., recording out of Columbus, Ohio. So for this episode here for you is going to be my celebration of St. Patrick's Day, number 5, fifth year in a row that I've been doing this. So the two featured reviews I have for you are going to be Leprechaun 6, Back to the Hood, and then I'm pairing that up with Imaginary. So this doesn't make the greatest double feature here, but we do have two supernatural entities, one in the Leprechaun, and then we have something that's an imaginary friend in Imaginary. So those are going to be the two featured reviews, and then I have mini-reviews of The Addiction. I went to the Gateway Film Center to see this one. My Foray Through the Fours rewatch is Death Dream, a.k.a. Dead of Night. Then I gave a watch to Another Evil. I actually watched my 4K of The Hills Have Eyes, the original one from 1977, and then went back to the Gateway Film Center to watch Fright Night from 1985, and also have an episode in there for you of The Walking Dead, The Ones Who Lived. So I don't think there's anything else I need to get you up to speed with here then for this intro. So what I will say then is thank you so much for listening, and I hope you enjoy coming on this journey with me.
Journey with a Cinephile.
And my first mini review is going to be The Addiction. This is from 1995, directed by Abel Ferreira, written by Nicholas St. John, stars Lily Taylor, Christopher Walken, and Annabella Soria? Shora, I don't know how to say her last name, so I do apologize there. But this is a drama horror film from the United States, currently sitting on a 6.4 on IMDb and a 3.6 on Letterboxd, or synopsis. A New York philosophy grad student turns into a vampire after being bitten by one, and then tries to come to terms with her new lifestyle and frequent craving for human blood. So this is an interesting film for me. I had never heard about this one, but it was listed in the Horror Show Guide Encyclopedia that I'm working my way through. This is one of the first art house horror films that sent me down the path that I'm on now. It's an interesting take on the vampire mythos, for sure. Now, I've seen this a few times, with the most recent at the Gateway Film Center, so yeah, I got to see this at the theater. And I should say that our kind of grad student that we're referring to is Kathleen Conklin, portrayed by Taylor. And so what we're getting here, though, is I didn't necessarily know what to expect the first time coming in, and I'm glad that I've seen this multiple times. This is an interesting take, as I said, on vampires. From its title, you get the idea that this is being treated like a drug, which it is. Kathleen was just a normal student before meeting Casanova, who's portrayed by Shiora. Now, part of this is the loss of innocence, and there's also this idea of how an attack can completely alter the course of your life. So Kathleen, being a philosophy student, is intriguing. She has a bleak outlook on life to start this movie, but to be honest, I get it. The older I get, the more I realize how humans are garbage. I love using the backdrop of war crimes from Vietnam as a way at looking at vampirism. Kathleen is upset with the treatment of the military officer, but she's doing the same thing that he is. I think this film shows that we shouldn't necessarily judge people while we live in glass houses. So it was also her new addiction, her inability to control to something else. Now, in 95 when this came out, I was 8. I feel like this tells us about the epidemic of people using drugs. We also get references to AIDS, so that was also a concern. I'm also thinking there is the issue with like college students back then. Kathleen literally shoots up with her professor, and it doesn't seem to be that big of a deal. I feel like this shows us a real problem. Kathleen can't control herself as a vampire, and it takes the character of Pena, portrayed by Walken, to call her out. He couldn't either at first, but it's interesting. Now, Casanova is the one who turns her, but we don't really see all that much about her. I'm not sure how bad her addiction is, but her being a woman is disarming, so I like that angle that she's the one that attacks and causes Kathleen to start being sick. So this has a low running time, so that keeps us moving. It is deliberately paced. It's interesting to see Kathleen as she descends into this madness of her addiction. There is a stimulating climax that is great at what she plans. I like that this is saying about higher education. The ending, I'm not completely sure what it's saying outside of the death of humanity of our lead. Something that this is carried by is its acting. I would say that Taylor is great here. I've already touched on liking that they made her a philosophy student. They aren't already, you know, they're already head cases and questioning everything around them. I love that she is sinking deeper into addiction. Her outlook becomes bleaker. Walken is solid in his small part, as well as Shiora. Now, she is easy on the eyes as well. There are cameos here of people who will go on to do bigger things to help round to the software what was needed. Shoutouts to Edie Falco. We also have Fredo Starr. There is Catherine Irby and Michael Imperioli. The cast is good across the board in a subdued way. All that's left would be filmmaking. This is something that I was wanting to cover as it's an art house movie. This is shot in black and white. This would have made me avoid this growing up, but it works for the narrative. It just adds a layer to me that I can't really describe. It makes it interesting as well that it hides the effects and makes them look better. The blood is dark, so you know what it is. This also makes the attack scenes more visceral as well, and I mean, it also helps to hide things because this doesn't have the largest budget. The cinematography is also good. I love how it's framed. I'm familiar with a little bit of Ferreira's work, seeing a handful of his films to this point. He also captures that grittiness of New York City before it fully got cleaned up. Now, the last aspect would be soundtrack. This doesn't stand out overall, but it does fit. I do like the use of rap music. We have a song by Cypress Hill, which I thought was great, as it's talking about getting high. That fits the title and the larger theme. They also use it a couple of times. There's a song by Onyx that I thought worked well. On top of that, it doesn't shock me to see Russell Simmons is involved with the production. So in conclusion, I like this movie. They decided to do something a bit different with the vampire creature. Setting in New York City is great, especially because it isn't as gritty as the 80s, but they're still getting a little bit of that. There are still aspects of, like, you know, school of higher education is close to, like, a rough neighborhood. Big fan of the climax, and the ending is intriguing. The acting is good across the board. This is well made. I enjoy stylistic choices. Being filmed in black and white adds a layer to it and helps to make the effects look that much better. Soundtrack fit for what was, you know, needed there. Not one that I can recommend to everybody. I wouldn't even say to watch this regularly. One that, if you enjoy art house films, that periodically is good to check out with some social commentary and a message that it carries. Check this out, then. So my rating here for The Addiction is going to be, after all these viewings that I've done of it now, an 8 out of 10 once more. And my next mini review here is going to be my Foray Through the Fours rewatch of Dead of Night, aka Death Dream. This is from 1974, directed by Bob Clark, written by Alan Ormsby. This stars John Marley, Lynn Carlin, and Richard Backus. This is a drama, horror, thriller film that is a co-production between the United Kingdom and Canada. Currently sitting on a 6.6 on IMDb and a 3.5 on Letterboxd, or synopsis being, a young soldier killed in Vietnam inexplicably shows up to his family home one night. So this is one that I didn't know about until hearing about it discussed on Horror Movie Podcasts. It didn't click either that this was directed by Bob Clark, who is has an interesting filmography with things like A Christmas Story and Black Christmas. This is a much different film for him as well. So the whole main premise here, I'm going to give a little bit more in depth, is that we have Andy, who is portrayed by Beck, is coming home as we see him in the opening shots being killed in Vietnam. Now his father is Charles, portrayed by Marley, and then his mother is Christine, portrayed by Carlin. And then he also has a sister of Kathy, portrayed by Anya Ormsby. Now, when he comes home, he's not normal, he's different. So we know who, like, and on his way home, actually, he kills a truck driver who he hitchhikes with. So I like that this doesn't hide the fact that he's probably the one who killed him. And this is revealed from the first kill. Now, the police, when they are investigating this, notice that there's a prick on this, like, arm of the truck driver, where it looks like it could have been a needle. So they're starting to wonder if there was, like, dope involved. And it's much darker when we learn the truth. I should also say my opening thoughts here is that this is really a character study of Andy, his return, and the effects of his return has on his family, as well as kind of him being over in the military. So let's start delving into a bit more with Andy. It doesn't give too much information as to why he comes back or what he's become. I don't mind this to an extent. It's almost like a variation on a vampire. I don't think that this matters to the filmmaker, though. This is really more of like an allegory for PTSD. We can see that Andy has been shell-shocked to what happened with him in Vietnam, and he can't cope. He even confirms that he died. So this is socially relevant with soldiers that come home today, because for all intents and purposes, the Andy that they know has died, and we have this different thing that has come home. Going even farther than that, we have the postman portrayed by Arthur Anderson, as well as Charles, who both served in like World War II. So he is upset that Andy can't cope, and that would be the dad, which is a sentiment the older generation has in general. Talking about mental health, especially for men, is frowned upon with this older generation. They're supposed to be tough and just kind of dealing with it. I feel like this is stating that Andy doesn't have anyone he can connect with as an outsider. Another interesting aspect in this film is the mother of Christine. She reminds me of my mother. Not that if I went on a killing spree that she would completely, like, she would defend me with her dying breath. Like, she would definitely point out that I did things wrong, but here Christine really just is defending her son beyond belief. There's an interesting argument between her and Charles that she reveals that Andy is her favorite. I don't necessarily know if that's the case, but it's more that she lost him once. Christine does make a comment that the daughter of Kathy favored Charles where Andy favored her. The prospect of losing her son is too much, and now she's overprotective, and I did like that aspect. I think we'll go over to the acting then. It's a bit amateurish, but it doesn't ruin this movie. It does add a bit of charm. The only actor I recognized was Marley, as he was in The Godfather. He's the producer who gets into it, you know, with the Don and with Bobby Duvall's character. Now, his performance here was good and one of the strongest. He is solid as his father who loves his son, but there's also a moral obligation. The problem is that he doesn't understand what his son is going through and isn't supportive. On the other side, though, Carlin is a mother who is too supportive. She goes to the point where she's enabling him. There's a message here of being in the middle is probably the best place to be. Her performance was good as well. I thought Backus, with his feature film debut, did a good job at being someone as stoic as Andy. It is really eerie, and the stare that he just kind of has works for, like, the role. Ormsby works as Kathy. I'd say that we also have here Jane Daly, who is Joanne. This is Andy's girlfriend who stayed back. There's Michael Mazes, who is Bob. Now, he is seeing Kathy. I also like what Henderson Forsythe as Doc Allen does. So the rest of the cast kind of rounded us out for what was needed. All that's left in his filmmaking. First would be the effects. I thought they were solid. It's crazy to see Tom Savini, who was still unknown at the time, did them. I don't think he had a lot to work with, but it was good for this time. The blood looks solid. Some of the wounds don't necessarily hold up. The look of Andy when we see what he's become, I did enjoy that. There's some subtle things they do here that the longer he goes between attacks, his skin gets this look that it's like dying. I noticed it this time around. I'd say that the cinematography was good. How they frame things helped to find, like, to hide the seams when it was needed. The other aspect of the soundtrack being great. There's some eerie songs here, and they help to build the atmosphere. It has a synthwave feel that I just love, as I'm a mark for it. So in conclusion, this is a film that has an interesting message to convey. I love the concept of a soldier dying then coming home to his family. Even more that it's a variation on, like, the monkey's paw of, you know, be careful what you wish for. I would have liked to know what he is. I think that would have tightened up the ending for me. We also explore parents and doing the right thing versus protecting those that you love and at what cost. The acting isn't great. It has an amateur feel, but it isn't bad. This is well made. Thought this built the necessary tension and atmospheric thanks to the soundtrack. We don't have the best effects by Savini, but it still looks real enough. Credit there to the look of Andy and the blood. We have some socially relevant movie here that still holds up with things that we are looking at today. I'd recommend this to the fans of Bob Clark, movies of this era, or things that I said might tick boxes for you. And this is definitely kind of like one of those, like, grindhouse type style films. So my rating here for Dead of Night, aka Death Dream, is going to be an 8 out of 10. And I also gave a watch to Another Evil from 2016. This is directed by Carson Mell, who also wrote this. Stars Steve Issus, Mark Prochke, or Prochke, something like that, and Dan Bacadal. This is a comedy horror film that is from the United States, currently sitting on a 5.5 on IMDb and a 3.1 on Letterboxd or Synopsis. When ghosts invade their vacation home, a successful artist and his family hire an exorcist who may be frightened, may be more frightening than the spirits he's hired to destroy. So this is one that I heard about through podcasts. It went on a list that multiple shows covered it, so I made it a point to check out. My guess is that this would have been on a year-end show, or like when I first got into listening, so I'm not fully sure where I heard about this one now. I didn't remember much what was said, so that allowed me to come into this one blind. So this is not the deepest story. But the family that we have here is Dan Papadakis, portrayed by Zissis. Now, he's married to Mary, portrayed by Jennifer Irwin, and they have a son of Jasper, who goes by Jazz, portrayed by Dax Flame. Now, they originally hired Joey Lee Dancing, who is portrayed by Bacaladal, who is the one. He comes in, he does tell them they have two ghosts living in their place, but he doesn't seem to think that there is an issue there. So then Dan ended up talking to his buddy of George, portrayed by Steve Little, who recommends that he check out As Bjorn, portrayed by Prosch. And then he's the one that comes in that might be a little bit more frightening. So I did see ahead of watching this that the Sundance Institute feature film program helped to fund this. We have a small cast, and this one is mostly set in one location. And it's kind of done that strategically, so that way we get to know more about Dan and As as they get to know each other. And then when it's time to go back to the real world, it causes issues. Now, since it's a character study of these two, I want to delve a bit deeper into them. And I'll start with As. He seems like a nice guy who's awkward. He has an aura about him when we first meet. The more that we get to know him, we see that he isn't as confident as he comes off. He has issues that he's dealing with, and he's also going through a divorce. There is something interesting that we see with intimacy when he hires a stripper. Proksh does a great job at taking this character and bringing it to life, and the more that we learn, we see that the layers that he has, and this brings it to life. So, you know, I will give him a lot more credit there. So on the other side, we have Dan. He's a good family man. He loves his wife and child. What is great is that he's an artist. He didn't know what he would do to take care of his family when Mary got pregnant at a younger age. Dan started painting circles, and they all sold out at a showing. He has continued doing this, and it makes him laugh because he made up why he started doing it. As says certain things that question his manliness, and I get that as a guy. I also like that he's annoyed with Joey when he won't get rid of the ghost. Issus is good as this, you know, he does a solid job at bringing this character to life as well. He's a sympathetic guy who just makes bad choices that lead to terrifying results. Let's go over to the rest of the cast then. Most of the actors that we have here are comedians, so I think that helps with timing. What makes sense is what we're doing here. I like Flame and Irwin as his family. I also love where things end up with them and the payoff that comes with it. It builds tension that we need. Bacaladal is good in his small role along with Little and his. It's actually kind of funny. I'm pretty sure Irwin and Little are both from Eastbound and Down. You know, kind of fun comedic show that has Danny McBride and like his crew. So I think that the whole cast here helps to push things to where they end up. All that's left in his filmmaking where I want to start is would be the editing and pacing. What is interesting here is that on paper, this should be boring. It doesn't come off that way though because of how it's constructed. This means that the cabin is haunted. We have Joey and As to assess it. I personally thought that these two were full of it, and they just are kind of taking money without doing anything to help. At least that's what I kind of thought we were going to get. This does confirm that this is haunted, though. I like how subdued the effects are. The two ghosts are only shown in flashes. That's done well. The cinematography is also good. I love the feeling of these two being isolated at this location. When it gets dark, I wasn't expecting where it would go. I'd also say that this sound design helps to build tension along with the soundtrack. So in conclusion, this is an under-talked about film. Do I think it's great? No, but it works well in the confines of what it's doing. We are taking the idea of a haunted house and grounding it with a realistic story. The acting helps bring the characters to life with Issus and Prosh leading the way. This is well made. I thought that the pacing was good along with the atmosphere and the cinematography helping there. One that I don't know if everyone will like, as it has an art house vibe to it, but this is a slow burn. I thought that it was good where it ended, so credit to that. So my rating here for this movie is going to be, which is another evil, is going to be a 7.5 out of 10. Then up next for you, I'm going to be a little bit brief because I've covered this previously, but this is going to be The Hills Have Eyes from 1977. This is the original. This is written and directed by Wes Craven. It is starring Susan Lanier, Robert Houston, and John Steadman. This is a horror thriller film that is from the United States. It is currently sitting on a 6.3 on IMDb and a 3.1 on Letterboxd, or a synopsis being. On the way to California, a family has the misfortune to have their car break down in an area closed to the public and inhabited by violent savages ready to attack. So I did a mini review on this in episode 49, which was Journey Through the Odds number 22, that featured The Flesh and the Fiends and Possessor. So for this one here, just to kind of give you a little bit more than what the back gave you there, is we have the Carter family. They are led by Big Bob, portrayed by Russ Grieve. Now with him is his daughter Brenda, portrayed by Lanyard, his son Bobby, portrayed by Robert Houston, and then there's also his other daughter of Lynn, portrayed by Dee Wallace, along with her husband Doug, portrayed by Martin Speer, their baby of Katie, portrayed by Brenda Marinoff, and then they're also joined by the mother of Ethel, portrayed by Virginia Vincent. So they head out to a silver mine that was given to the, you know, the parents here because of their 25th wedding anniversary, which is their silver one. And then it's here that they meet Fred, portrayed by Stedman, as he warns them from going out into the desert because there is a family led by Papa Jupiter, portrayed by James Whitworth, hunting the area. So this is a classic from Craven. What is interesting that in my head, this is worse than what it is. I think this does well in showing you enough, and then your imagination fills in the rest. The acting is good to bring the characters to life. The story and concept are terrifying. This one is toned down with the violence on the screen compared to its remake. It still builds tension and atmosphere, and it shocks me this was given an X rating when it first came out. I think this is kind of getting the Texas Chainsaw Massacre effect with it, but I'd recommend this one as a more mainstream grindhouse film. This one's more subdued than what Craven would do with Last House on the Left, but we're still kind of getting some terrifying things as we have, I mean, this is loosely based on the Shawnee Bean family from Scotland, who were, you know, cannibals and stuff, living on the fringes of everything and stuff like that. So I really enjoyed watching this. I actually got to see it in the theater the last time that I covered it, and I got to watch my 4K now at home. So I am now have settled on The Hills Have Eyes from 1977 being an 8.5 out of 10. And the last feature that I'm going to review on this episode is going to be Fright Night from 1985. This is directed by Tom Holland, who also wrote this. This is starring Chris Sarandon, William Ragsdale, and Amanda Bierce. This is a horror film that is from the United States. It is currently sitting on a 7.1 on IMDb and a 3.6 on Letterboxd with a synopsis being: a horror-obsessed teenager discovers the next-door neighbor is a murderous vampire. He tries to convince the police, his family, and friends, but to no avail. He decides to take matters into his own hands. So this is one that I used to watch parts of it growing up. One of my cousins recorded this, and that tape was at my grandma's house. I know that I finally watched it all the way through right after college and then gave it a rewatch at the Gateway Film Center. Now, they showed it on the VHS. Like, I showed a VHS tape of it the first time on the big screen. So then I went back, and I believe I might have saw it in the 4K, or it might have just been, you know, a digital version of this one. So what we're getting here is just like a variation on Dracula. We have Jerry Dandridge, who is Sarandon. Now he is the vampire who moves in next door. Now the hero is Charlie Brewster, portrayed by Ragsdale, and he's dating Amy Peterson, portrayed by Bierce. Now Charlie is obsessed that his neighbor could be a vampire, and this upsets Amy. So he goes about trying to prove this to everybody, and this ends up making him a target, and that is what kind of puts him in danger. So something that I've kind of realized these last couple times is there's some really interesting gay undertones to this movie. We have Jerry does fall in love with Amy, but we have a little bit of the Dracula motif here where Jerry has a painting that looks a lot like Amy, but he has this odd relationship with Billy Cole, who is portrayed by Jonathan Stark, who is his live-in carpenter. So he's a familiar who is in the vein of like Renfield, where he has supernatural abilities, but he's mostly human. They just kind of have these moments where they have weird interactions. That'd be Jerry and Billy. And then I also wanted to bring up, we have a little bit of pedophilia where Jerry is going after Amy as she's a high school student. So she's underage, where he is a vampire who is much, much older. So now that I have that out of the way, let's go to something that I really enjoy is the setting. So this is taking place in the suburb. I get confused about how big this town is, though, because there's a really seedy part that we see when Charlie is walking Amy home. There's like a nightclub there and everything like that. Now, we're also very close to a movie studio because this is where Peter Vincent, portrayed by Roddy McDowall, comes into play. Now, of course, his name is a play on Peter Cushing and Vincent Price, where he is a late-night horror host who also was an actor in some of the movies that he's showing. Let's talk about the acting performances. Sarandon is great as his vampire. He is suave and seductive, which his look helps to convey. Now, we have Amy and Judy Brewster. Now, Judy Brewster being the mother of Charlie, and that's portrayed by Dorothy Fielding. They both are attracted to Jerry from the jump. It makes sense because a vampire has the ability to kind of do this to people. I thought Ragsdale was good as his boyfriend, except I don't like that he doesn't know the role of a vampire being a horror fan. He does give off a little bit of a creepy vibe with Amy there in that opening sequence, but as an adult, it makes me uncomfortable. Bierce is attractive, and I feel bad for her. She really likes Charlie, but he just seems to have other things on his mind. McDowell was solid as his horror film host. I do like the change of character that we have in the internal struggle he deals with. Thought that Stephen Jeffries here is good as Evil Ed, who hates that nickname. He's annoying, but there's something endearing about it. He does have some of the more iconic lines in this film, and it makes me laugh. And he's actually our horror expert, and I feel kinship there. He's also good as a vampire as he gets turned. So I'd also say that Jonathan Stark as Billy Cole, Fielding as Judy, and then Art Evans as Detective Lennox, they're all solid here, and they helped to round out the cast where it was needed. All that's left is filmmaking. First, I'll start with the effects. Thought they were good as my starting point. I'm not always the biggest fan when the vampires turn into a monstrous-looking creature. unless that's like your whole like concept you're running with, I prefer them to just kind of have fangs. But the seams of the effects were kind of seen here. I did like that they could shape shift into like wolves, bats, and mists. That goes back to Dracula. They hide these effects, which is strategic to not look cheesy. That'll take me to the cinematography, which is good. This is helped by the framing to hide things. I also love the setting being in the suburb. How Jerry's house looks during the climax takes on that gothic feel that I appreciate. It also runs 105 minutes, but it's paced well. It doesn't take long to get into it, and then the tension builds as no one believes Charlie. Soundtrack is also good, has a great 80s vibe to it, and helps build tension as well. In conclusion, this is an 80s classic. I think that the story is a solid retelling of Dracula by converting it to the suburbs, much like you'd get with, like, Salem's Lot. I think it's great to have a teenager who's a horror film fan thinking that a vampire moves in, only to, you know, have it be true. There is tension built that no one believes him. It does have some interesting undertones of pedophilia and same-gender attraction. This is well made from the cinematography to the framing. The effects are good, with just a slight issue there with the looks of the vampires. Nowhere near close to ruining this, though. This is one of the better vampire films from the era, and I'd recommend this if you haven't seen it for a while, for sure. So my rating here for Fright Night, the one from 1985, is an 8.5 out of 10. And I'm going to go ahead and end this out with talking about an episode of The Walking Dead, The Ones Who Lived. This is the second episode of the season, which is Gone. This is, once again, directed by Bert and Bertie Elwood, written by Robert Kirkman, Tony Moore, and Charlie Adler, starring Andrew Lincoln, Danae Gurira, and Pollyanna McIntosh. And the synopsis on this episode is, after Rick sacrificed to save this group, everyone believed he was gone apart from a couple people who dedicated a long time to search for their friend. So this one, it starts off telling us we're 6 years after the bridge. We end up having, like, these leaders of this group that is working with Michonne, as we have Elle portrayed by Erin Anderson, and then her sister is Aiden portrayed by Breida Wool. She's an actress that I've seen in a few different little things here and there, and then she is dating, I believe it's Bailey, portrayed by Andrew Batchelor. So Michonne has saved this couple, and then she is asking for a horse from Elle, but Elle is giving her a hard time. Then we have Nat, who's portrayed by Matthew Jeffers. He comes in and is going off about how Elle has left her sister and her boyfriend behind, and then that's where they actually kind of realize that Michonne has saved them. So then we realize that there's this five-mile horde that does this. It's almost like migrating, and they're calling it the Wailing, which I thought was kind of a cool thing there. Now, Aiden, Bailey, and Nat all are a big fan of Michonne, and they want her to stay around. And we actually get this weird thing where they give her ways to distract this giant horde, and she ends up riding towards it with a sword. Now, she has these grenades that Nat has created. Now, something goes wrong here when one of the zombies has a gas can, and it blows up, knocking Michonne down. Then we end up seeing these two larger explosions that part these zombies and everything. And then we actually learn that Aiden is pregnant. We actually get a great story about Nat from before everything went down. There's some good cinematography here with reflections in a window. And then we actually have these helicopters that are from the CRM dropping gas. And it's kind of like mustard gas that they're using here, as it's chlorine, actually. So this one actually injures everybody involved, and they have to hide out in a nearby mall to recover from everything. There's an eerie song used here that I love. Reminds me of 28 Days Later there. And we end up seeing spending all winter in this mall, and Nat is not going to leave Michonne behind or try to leave or anything like that. And it's actually kind of gets quite depressing as they get to this terminal that Michonne's looking for, and there's a bunch of bodies that are burned, piles and piles, and she thinks she finds Rick's boots. So then we shift to now, as they're heading home because of just things that they found here. And this is where we realize that the helicopter that got shot down was actually done by Nat and Michonne. And Rick was part of it. And now he makes a plan with her that she needs to join the CRM, pretend to be weak and not know him. The thing is, we end up seeing Pollyanna McIntosh's character here, of Jadis Stokes, as she knows. So I give this episode a 7 out of 10. It's building some interesting stuff here. Still don't necessarily know how I feel about this one. I know people are giving this like some high ratings here at like 9s. I don't go that high. I just feel like we have people who love Walking Dead stuff so much that they're going to give it high ratings and everything like that. I'm still going to stick around with it. I've actually started the third episode, but I'm still not completely done with it as of yet. So hopefully I'll have that one up for next episode here. And that one is called Bye. So that's all I have here for mini review. So let me get you over to the trailer of my first featured review.
Leprechauns, born of earth magic. They were protectors of the king's gold and punish anyone who would steal it. But after the king died, they were all whisked away back into the earth, except for one.
around here?
Yeah. I haven't smoked a good pipe in a long time.
I see power coming.
You filthy mortals have tried to steal my riches. Hello, love.
It's a leprechaun and he's after us. He wants his gold back.
Come on! Oh!
Damn!
Who the fuck just took my shit?
You compromised all you believed in once you got the gold.
No more running.
I like her.
You're going back to hell tonight.
How tall are you, sweetie?
About 3'6".
3'6"?
I make up for it in other areas.
Oh, this is wonderful working, baby. Woo! Wonder!
Hello?
And for my first featured review here in celebration of St. Patrick's Day is going to be Leprechaun 6 Back to the Hood. This is from 2003, directed by Stephen Iromlou. I think that's how you might say that. He also wrote this along with Mark Jones being credited for coming up with the characters. Stars Warwick Davis, Tangi Miller, and Laz Alonso, while also featuring Paige Kennedy, Sherry Jackson, Donzili Abernathy, Sheikh Mohammed Bey, Sticky Fangas, Keisha Sharp, Sonia Eddy, Bo Billingsley, Christopher Murray, Vicky Lynn Reynolds, Willie C. Carpenter, Varee, J. Karen Thomas, Evan Mann, and Mo McRae. This is a comedy fantasy horror film from the United States, currently sitting on a 3.9 on IMDb and a 2.1 on Letterboxd with our synopsis. When Emily Woodrow and her friends happen upon a treasure chest full of gold coins, they do not heed the warnings of a wise old psychic who foretold that they would meet trouble with a nasty and protective leprechaun. Should say Emily is portrayed by Miller, and Leprechaun, of course, is Warwick Davis. So, this is a movie that, I'll be honest, I avoided it when I saw it hit the movie channels. I didn't see this one, for like the one right before it, for the same reason. It wasn't until getting into horror movie podcasts that I decided to end up working through this series. Now, since I'm celebrating St. Patrick's Day here on the podcast, this was the next one in line that I hadn't seen yet. So let's do some feature notes first. I'll start with our director of Iromlou. Has helmed 3 films. I've only ever seen this one, only one that has been in genre. As a writer, this is his only credit there. This is the, given some credit here to the original writer of Jones as well. The only projects that he has are the Leprechaun series, and I've seen all of them now. I'll then take this to the cast, starting with Davis. He has been in 62 films. I've seen 25. That's 40% overall. I've seen him in like the different Star Wars and Harry Potter films, as well as Willow. Now, he's my 15th most seen actor because of that. He's also been in 6 shorts. He's been in 9 horror films. I've seen 77% outside of the Leprechaun movies and Skin Deep. I've not seen St. Bernard and Small Town Folk. Then over to Miller. She's been in 14 films. I've only ever seen this. Has one other horror film that was from the following year of Phantom Force, which I have not heard of. Then last will be Alonzo. He's been in 32 films and 1 short. I've seen 9 of them. He was in Avatar, Fast and the Furious, as well as Jarhead. Has 5 in genre. I've seen this, Constantine in Captivity. I have not seen Traffic or All Souls Day. That's the only other one that he has as well. So then, let's get into this movie here. Now, we start out learning a bit more of the lore of the leprechauns. There was a king who enlisted their aid to protect his gold. All of them returned to where they came from except one. That would be the leprechaun that we're getting here. It then shifts to the present day where we have Father Jacob, portrayed by Carpenter, who battles this mythical creature on the site of what would be a youth center. Like, it's in construction. Now, he ends up defeating it, and the monster is pulled into the ground. We then shift a year into the future. Father Jacob died during that battle, and the construction of the youth center died with him. Hanging outside of the construction site are Emily with her friend Lisa, portrayed by Jackson. Now, also with them is Paige, portrayed by Kennedy. It is during this that we see Rory, portrayed by Alonzo, who used to be dating Emily. They broke up when he took money from her and then started to deal drugs with the money that he borrowed. Now, he is seeing Chanel, portrayed by Keisha Sharp. Jamie is also attacked by another group of drug dealers. Their boss is Watson, portrayed by Mahmoud Bey. And he rolls up with Cedric, portrayed by Fingas. Now, Jamie owes them money, and he's short on it. So Rory comes to his aid, and this causes Watson to tell him that he better, kind of watch himself. So then Emily and Lisa throw a cookout at the construction site. Jamie invited Rory, which upsets Emily. These two go off to talk, and she falls through the floor. It is while she waits for Rory to get a ladder or like a rope or something, she ends up finding this chest full of gold coins. She decides to split it with the group. She doesn't want Rory or Jamie to use it on drugs, which they do. But by them spending this, a leprechaun wakes up and is searching for his gold, which, you know, shouldn't shock anybody there. And he kills anyone who will get in his way to get it back. So that's what I'm going to leave my recap and introduction to the characters. What I like is that we get more continuity than other sequels in the series. They don't reference the movie before this, but that doesn't do anything to violate the continuity there either. Another thing that I'll give this one credit is that it feels like it's written by a black man. The references to the culture feels more real and less awkward, so that helps as well. So a big thing that I want to credit here is I love the backstory that we do have. This idea that we have a king enlisted the aid of the leprechauns is great, and this being like a fairy tale. I love that the rest of them left after there was no longer being needed to help or anything like that. I do still think that there's a missed opportunity here. Something that that was in the synopsis that was brought up that I didn't know was the idea that Emily sees a psychic with Lisa. Now, obviously I know that because I saw the movie and everything, but the psychic keeps getting the names wrong, but she warns Emily about a fortune that will come her way and how she needs to avoid it. She doesn't, of course, so that sets the events in motion. I love that the leprechaun almost seems to fear the psychic and calls her a witch. He won't even mess with her until she interferes. The idea here is that the only people who are killed either try to stop or are, you know, showing greed of his gold. So I did like how they're playing with that idea there. Now, I've already touched on this, but I do love having this leprechaun attacking the neighborhood. I can't fault the characters that when they find the gold, they spend it. This is the same argument that I have when it came to college athletes who were busted for accepting benefits that, you know, were illegal at the time. You only saw it from, you know, teens that came from nothing. They don't know good spending habits, so it tracks. The idea that greedy leprechaun would have run-ins with people who don't have anything, so they spend newfound money selfishly makes sense and works. I wanted to credit that. So let's shift over to the acting. I'll be honest, it isn't great. This also isn't working with the biggest budget either. Davis is once again on point with not only knowing and looking menacing, but hitting the one-liners. I appreciate him for doing this when he was already taking on like Star Wars movies as well as ones in Harry Potter series. Miller and Jackson are fine as best friends. Kennedy adds comedy, which worked for me. Alonzo was fine as his drug dealer who used to be part of the group. What is confusing there is that he still loves Emily, but is also dating Chanel. I would say Abernathy is good as Esmeralda the Psychic. That's a limited role there. Mahmud Bey and Fengas and his crew were good. I'd say the supporting casts were almost caricatures, but that's fine for a supernatural slasher like this. So before I do some trivia, all that's left is filmmaking. I'd say the cinematography is fine. We are capturing that this is a low-income area. Seeing this group buy things that they don't need makes sense. It also fits why the monster is after them. The effects were also fine. This leans a bit more into the CGI than the practical ones. I do wish that we'd got more of that latter, though. This doesn't ruin the movie, though, either. I'd say the soundtrack also works. It does have, like, a rap-style music that, once again, would fit the area that this is being set in. So some of the trivia here is obviously the last entry for Leprechaun, where Warwick Davis is taking on that role. This has a new outfit in the movie, giving it a more demonic look. It's the only movie where you see Leprechaun's bare feet. So it actually sounds like the director of the previous movie, Rob Spira, was involved in its early stages. And there was two ideas that were proposed, one set in Venice Beach and the other one on an island during spring break. However, the strong home video sales of the previous one resulted in the producers wanting to keep it in the inner city with a cast primarily made up of rappers. Not wanting to rehash the previous film, Spira left and was replaced by the director that we have here, who was a hardcore fan of the series at that point. So that's kind of good there. This one has some lines that were reflected in earlier films, like the Damn Clovers line and the Eye for an Eye, Me Dear, was used in the original. This is a 6 movie. Although the number 6 doesn't appear anywhere in the title or the credits, there is the book that has the legend in it that says Chapter 6, and I might even say Chapter 666. There's a Wilhelm scream during the opening animation and monologue when the leprechauns surround and pounce on the knight. According to Tony Todd, there was an idea here of potentially doing a Leprechaun versus Candyman in the wake of Freddy versus Jason. Now, it looks like the franchises were both being owned by the same people, but that was canceled when he turned it down. Esmeralda's death is off-screen, and that's because the director here didn't want to show the Leprechaun using too much magical powers, because he actually thought that he was too overpowered by, you know, wiggling his fingers. And this wanted to have, like, instead giving it more, like, supernatural strength. When the reading the script, Davis felt it was a unique change to play a more physical threat. This one, we also have a more, like, darker gothic Victorian style, taking away, like, the buckles and stripes and give it more mute colors and everything, and having longer claws so he could kill victims in a swipe like a vicious animal. There's actually some stuff here that is reminiscent of Friday the 13th, Part 8, Jason Takes Manhattan, where there's some characters who are actually physically attacking the leprechaun. Kind of thought that was a little bit interesting, kind of change to do there. So what I will say is that, in conclusion, I enjoyed this one more than some of the latter sequels. This is a franchise that is middling, even with the best ones. The bright spots would be like Davis' performance as a leprechaun, and the makeup is on point. His comedy lands. The rest of the cast was fine. I do like the extra bit of backstory that we have. This is made well enough. The practical effects are good, but we get a bit too much CGI in general. Again, this is one of the better sequels, which is impressive being this far into the series. I'd only recommend this one if you enjoy these movies and want to see a supernatural slasher being done by a mythical creature. So my rating here for Leprechaun 6, Back to the Hood, is going to be a 5.5 out of 10. Not going to do a spoiler section, don't need to do anything there, so let me get you over to the trailer of my second featured review.
Hey kids, do you want a friend who will never leave your side? Introducing Chauncey the Bear. He'll never leave you. Never, ever.
It's nice to see you again, Alice. Jessica told me you've been spending time with a new friend.
He doesn't want me to talk to you. Chauncey? My favorite thing is his eyes. I can see anything I can imagine in them.
He asked you to do something that hurt you.
Every culture has a name for it. We call them imaginary friends. Just because you stop believing in them doesn't mean they're gone. And they're angry that you left.
For my second feature review here is going to be Imaginary. This is from 2024, directed by Jeff Wadlow, who also helped write this with Greg Erb and Jason Ormland. This stars DeWando Vize, Tegan Burns, and Piper Braun, while also featuring Betty Buckley, Tom Payne, Veronica Falcone, Samuel Sellery, Matthew Sato, Alex Angelis, Vaitin Valmzy, Rhythm Hurd, Sean Sands, Lawrence J. Weber Jr., Noah Martinez, Lily Sunshine, Cecilia Lay, Eduardo Campriano, who I did see him in a movie last year, and Michael Beckenmeyer. This is a horror mystery thriller film that is from the United States. This is a Blumhouse film as well. But this is sitting on a 4.9 on IMDb and a 2.2 on Letterboxd, with our synopsis being: a woman returns to her childhood home to discover that the imaginary friend that she left behind is real and unhappy that she abandoned him. So this is one of my more anticipated ones for 2024. My interest did wane when I saw that this was a Blumhouse film. It didn't help that there were mixed reviews, mostly leaning negatively. Now, being PG-13 isn't the biggest issue for me, but knowing that it's Blumhouse, they tend to not necessarily work. For what I'm kind of looking for, and I'm not necessarily the target audience. I did still go see this the opening weekend. It didn't go to the Gateway, so I had to go to the theater. It's actually closer to my house, but I actually had to pay for it with a gift card. So then, let's get over to the featured notes here, and I'll start with our director of Wadlow. He has helmed 8 films, as he's worked with Blumhouse, it looks like. Now, he's also done two shorts. I've seen six of the things that he's done. Not in horror, I've seen Kick-Ass 2 and Never Back Down. In genre, he has five. I've seen four. I've seen this, Truth or Dare of 2018, Fantasy Island, and Cry Wolf. The only thing I haven't seen that he's done in the genre is The Curse of Bridge Hollow. Then over to him as a writer, he has nine features and one short. I've seen six of what he's done. Has five in horror, and I've seen all of them now. He has wrote that Truth or Dare, Fantasy Island, Cry Wolf. And then he also wrote Prey from 2007, which was like a lion attack type movie. So his co-writer of Herb has seven that he's written. I've only ever seen this, and I've seen most of Rocket Man, which I didn't realize is a Disney movie. That's a Harlan Williams movie, I think that's his name. So he did write The Princess and the Frog, as well as the odd comedy Senseless that features David Spade and one of the Wayans brothers. So this is the only thing he's done in horror. And the final writer is going to be Orm Land. Now, he's worked with Herb in the past, and this is the only one that I've seen and that he's done in horror. Then to our cast, I will start here with Wise, as she has 14 films and four shorts. I've seen her in Someone Great, which was an odd comedy that Jamie showed me, but this is her only one in horror. Next is Burns. She has six features. This is the only one that I've seen and only one she's done in horror. Last is Braun. She's done two movies. I've only ever seen this and her only one as well. Once again, that is in horror. So then we start with a woman being chased on a corridor of doors by what looks like a monster. Now, she wakes up in bed, and it is through this that we learn it was a nightmare. So this is our lead of Jessica, portrayed by Wise. Now, she's married to Max, who's portrayed by Payne. He is divorced due to his wife having a mental break. Now, we do see her briefly, and she is Samantha, portrayed by Angelis. He comes with two daughters, the older one being Taylor, portrayed by Burns, who dislikes her new stepmother. The younger one, who tries to give her a chance, is Alice, portrayed by Braun. So Jessica is dealing with these nightmares, so Max suggests that they should move faster than what they planned. Now, they're going to Jessica's childhood home, since her father now resides in a retirement spot. I guess retirement home. What is interesting there is that she doesn't have the best memories, so it seems odd to me that they're going to move to this house and how it would help. Regardless, they do. Now, we get an interesting scene where Jessica and Alice are connecting with each other, but Taylor puts a stop to it. Jessica takes her room that she had growing up to be her studio. Now, she's an artist for children's books that she, I think she also writes them, or at least comes up with the idea of a millipede that is chased by a spider. So the spider scares Alice, who we see has burn scars on her arm. Now, there's a dark reason here that her mother did it. The move does help with Jessica's nightmares. There is a teen guy who lives nearby of Liam, portrayed by Santo, who Taylor is attracted to. Alice also meets a new imaginary friend of Chauncey. At first, Jessica and Max think it's cute that Alice believes so much in Chauncey. A neighbor by the name of Gloria, portrayed by Buckley, was Jessica's babysitter and reminds her that she had an imaginary friend living there as well. Interestingly enough, his name was also Chauncey. Concern grows when this entity wants to play a dark scavenger hunt with Alice. The reward could also tear this family apart. So as I leave my recap introduction to the characters, where I want to start is that we have some great concepts behind this. I like the idea of imaginary friends being real and entities that only children can see. That's creepy. There are ones who are benevolent, just there to, you know, be friendly while, you know, a kid grows up and just kind of needs somebody that they need, that they can talk to and kind of confide in, while the one that we have in this movie has a nefarious plan. I like that it's set up that this happens across cultures. It is also an interesting idea to play with that Jessica had the same one that Alice is now interacting with as well. So that's a good overview to set up what this movie is doing. There is depth added here that Jessica was taken from her father to be raised by her grandparents. She doesn't remember this, but she knows that she was. She does have scars on her forearm. I do find it slightly problematic that she wants to move back to the house that she lived in until she was five, knowing that she was taken away from her father. Alice and even a bit of Taylor have a shared experience that their mother went crazy. Alice has burns on her forearm. Shared trauma is something that you can bond over, even more so that Chauncey capitalizes on it with both. Another aspect that I like is that Jessica grew up to draw and paint these stories. We know from her introduction to her studio that she was into art growing up. I like that this shows that Chauncey targeted her creativity. This allows Jessica to piece things together when Alice disappears. It also helps to fill in backstory that she played the scavenger hunt game as well. Now, despite all these good things, I had problems here. The first one is that this is too long. My interest waned after the opening act. What is crazy there is that we have Alice in peril, so I should be there, especially because I have a daughter. After that introduction, though, it just took a long time to the stinger for me, which involves Dr. Soto, portrayed by Falcone. There is a reveal there that hooked me back in. The problem then is that I again lose interest. This also plays with the idea that we don't know what is a dream and what is real. I'm not always the biggest fan there. I do think that this is good to mess with our character's head, but it just felt too convenient from something that happens, and playing with the ending lost me. I don't hate this, though. I did want to say that. Now, where I'll then go is filmmaking, since I've covered the pacing. I like what they do with perspective, so I'll credit the cinematography. We get to see something that might be real with Chauncey. That was cool, and then showed us the truth. This also goes to the other side, where the entity is from. And I'm actually going to jump over to some trivia here, is that something that was kind of thought up here is that Wadlow cited Poltergeist as an influence on this. It perfectly strikes the balance between scares and this benign sense of wonder and excitement and emotion that you get when you have a family that you care about. I don't know if it hits as well as he thought it did, but I'll digress there. So the best part as well is that there's an effect done where the monster is mimicking people. That's terrifying. Credit to that. I don't know if they utilize the other side well enough, though. They are supposed to be playing with perspective. We needed a bit more of that. The effects were fine. There is CGI here that isn't great. The practical effects, though, were, you know, solid. There are things done where we see an entity hiding where characters don't notice them. That's creepy. The use of sound design made me uncomfortable, so credit to that. Soundtrack, other than that, was just fine for what was needed. So all that's left for a couple more pieces of trivia is acting. Thought that Wise was good as our lead. I like that she's in this awkward position of being a stepmother. Alice is young enough to entertain the idea where she has battles with Taylor. Burns has pretty eyes and plays this insufferable teen well. It is cliched, but I get why it's there. Braun is good as this little girl who is a target of the entity. I do like that Buckley is used here as a link to Jessica's childhood and the present. Now, she also has done research since she's there to fill information in. Payne works the father, but to be honest, he disappears from this. Other than that, I thought that Falcone, Samuel Salary, and Santo and the rest of the cast were fine for what was needed. Just kind of round things out here. I'll be honest, like, nobody really kind of stands out. So, I mean, I wouldn't come here for the... I mean, I would say that our three leads are probably, you know, worth the price of admission. But, yeah, there's still some issues here. So then the other pieces of trivia is the first trailer, which premiered in front of Five Nights at Freddy's, consisted almost entirely of sound effects over a blank screen, encouraging audiences to use their imagination. Gimmicky, I can appreciate that. The family moves into a house on Elm Street in Springwood, a reference to Nightmare on Elm Street from 84, another imaginary villain proven to be real. That one's a little bit of a stretch there, but in conclusion, this does some good things. We have a creepy concept and the backstory works for me. The problem is that it takes too long in between what works, so my interest wanes. The acting was solid with Wise, Burns, and Braun leading the way. I think this is made well enough, aside from the length, pacing, and some of the CGI effects. There are creepy things done here with the visuals and soundtrack. I was even creeped out when we know the entity is in the room, even if the characters don't. This falls short, though. That's a shame. I still don't think this is as bad as some people are saying, but I actually had a buddy right before I started recording just say it was kind of generic, which I do agree with that. That's a good way to describe this. So my rating here for Imaginary is going to be a 6 out of 10. Not going to do a spoiler section. Don't really necessarily think there's anything I need to delve into deeper. So let me get you over to one last break before I close out the show. And welcome back one last time here. And just to kind of go through my social medias and stuff, if you'd like to send me an email, you can send that at journeywithacinephile@gmail.com. You can send me any sort of feedback, or if you have any questions or anything, go ahead and shoot them there, and I'll get back to you as soon as I can. Or if you want to send me any screener links or anything like that, anything podcast-related, you can send it via that way. If you'd like to read any of the written reviews, I'll direct you to Reviews of the Dead, and that's horrorreview.webnode.com. If you'd like to become friends with me on Facebook, I'm David Michigan Garrett Jr. On Twitter, I'm Buckeye from Mish. Letterboxd, I'm David OSU. On Instagram, I'm DavidOSU87. On Threads, I'm DavidOSU87. And then Journey with a Cinephile has its own Instagram at Journey with a Cinephile, all one word. Now, all of these ones I will be sharing, like, my ratings on, whatnot. I know for Letterboxd, all of the reviews are going to be for horror and non-horror alike. Instagram I will be sharing over there is my different, like, posters and everything for things that I'm reviewing. My personal account, you might see some personal pictures every now and then if I can remember to take them. And then, you know, kind of same thing for Threads. And then Journey with a Cinephile is going to be more of just kind of posting podcast-related different stuff over there. And I'll also direct you to the Nightclub Discord channel, as I have a little section over there where we have some good conversations. I post all of my reviews and any new podcast episodes or some of the things I'm watching when I actually have time to post that. So keep an eye out over there, and I'll have the link for that and everything else in the show notes there. And then I'm also going to direct you, if a way that you can actually listen to the show is going to be through the Pod Nation TV. This is a streaming service and everything like that. There'll be a link in the blog posts for all of my episodes, so if you'd like to listen to it that way, it's kind of a cool little thing. You can definitely do that through like Roku TV, and there's some other apps for it as well, just as another way for you to consume this podcast if you decide to. And there's also a lot of other great shows that are on that network as well. And for my next episode is going to be going back to doing my Centennial Club, as the older film from 1924 that I'm going to be watching is Dante's Inferno. So this one, right now my plan is to go to the Gateway Film Center to watch Immaculate. The problem is I like to watch these usually this opening weekend, but I'm pretty sure this movie is not hitting the theater until like Friday at the end of the week, which would mean that this would be one of the last films that I watch get recorded and everything. So depending on how things go down, I might end up pushing that one till the week after, and I will watch something at home that is on streaming or something like that. But I will have two featured reviews for you that are going to be, you know, my Centennial Club thing. And then I'm also going to be watching Blood for Dracula. That's going to be the Foray Through the Fours rewatch that I do. Now, I want to go to the Gateway Film Center to watch Byzantium. I don't think it's going to work out, but I do have a couple of screeners. One of them is an Easter horror movie. The other one is a short film. So I'll have both of those on there, but that should, and I'll also have more mini reviews for you. So I will have a full episode and everything like that. So I don't think there's anything else I need to get to speed with here for this outro. So what I will say is thank you so much for listening. Whatever you do today, I hope you're safe and doing, have a great time out there. This is your tour guide of David Garrett Jr., and I am signing off.
It had been a wonderful evening, and what I needed now to give it the perfect ending.